Good morning. This is Sunstone Session 321. The paper is Are We Latter-day Saints? Resources in Mormonism for Affirming the Paranormal. We'd like to first hear from Dan Witherspoon. Dan is the rare book buyer of Benchmark Books. He is an instructor in philosophy and ethics at the Salt Lake Community College. And his PhD is from Claremont Graduate School in Philosophy of Religion and Theology. We'd then like to hear from Randall Paul with a response. Randall is a directing trustee of the Foundation for Interreligious Diplomacy. He has his PhD from the University of Chicago, and his PhD was in the Committee on Social Thought. We'd like to hear from Dan now. Thank you.
So I'll join hands and chant now. Because they occur within a religious context, and most of us who believe them give general consent to the idea that we live in a universe that is ordered by an active and interested God, we as Latter-day Saints often fail to think about the radical nature of many of our claims, practices, and the events within our history. We very seldom step back to notice that were they to be explained phenomenologically, many of our assertions, if considered literally, would fall under the broad classification of paranormal or psi phenomena. For instance, our normal tendency is to classify our belief in the power of discernment, either in counseling situations or more extravagantly in patriarchal blessings, as some sort of gift of the spirit. Yet to parapsychologists, such a claim would easily fall within the broad classification of ESP, extrasensory perception. Likewise, we'll allow the phrase I don't need it yet, please, Scott. Likewise, we'll allow the phrase that he translated the Book of Mormon by the gift and power of God roll off our tongues, yet forget that to psychical researchers, his use of seer stones would immediately be labeled as a claim for some sort of clairvoyance, or as Scott Dunn has argued, automatic writing. Our claims about the efficacy of prayer and certain healing practices would be seen as assertions of action at a distance. Our contention that Joseph Smith was literally visited by embodied heavenly beings would be classified as a claim of superluminary, or faster-than-light travel. These different contexts for viewing these same claims immediately raise two challenges for us as religionists. First, it asks us to ponder the degree to which we are willing to allow that which is sacred and close to our hearts be subjected to, evaluated by, and possibly demystified by those for whom these phenomena might be seen as interesting at best or primitive superstition at worst. And second, it challenges us to acknowledge in a serious way the possible continuities between our faith claims about really real phenomenon and the sort of fringy feeling claims and ideas we've heard about. Rumors of unusual psychic events or extraordinary powers and abilities that occur outside of religious contexts, or notions of radical interconnectedness and those la-la-land sort of slogans that imply some sort of efficacy to visualizing world peace. In the interest of time, I wrote about a 40-page paper, and it's now down to in the mid-20s, so I promise you I won't be going much more than 35, 40 minutes. I'm going to skip the next three or four pages, which is basically my attempt to explain where my interest in psi came from. There I acknowledge that it isn't because I myself have any sort of psychic abilities. So I sometimes long and wish either for some event to take place in my presence or something, but it certainly hasn't. Instead, I try to place myself within the context of speculative philosophy, which Whitehead describes as the attempt to imagine a scheme that is coherent, logical, and in respect to its interpretation, both applicable and adequate. And of these four, psi relates primarily to that last of those, adequacy. For Whitehead, that means there are no items incapable of interpretation within the overall scheme. So in other words, I'm a grand theory guy. Just temperamentally, I enjoy the widest possible context. I like theories that at least attempt to account for everything. So as I began my encounters with parapsychology, it was with the question, okay, which of these strange things that I've heard about will I really have to take seriously in my theory making? I do not have the time today to present the evidences that moved me, but as you may have guessed by the subtitle of my presentation, Affirming the Paranormal, I decided that there were many. Next, in those pages, speak about my Mormonism and how when I brought that in there, certainly there was a loss. I'm not sure I imagined a whole lot of radical difference between us, but certainly there were any claims that psychical abilities or special powers were Mormon provenance, you know, that they were in our thing, went out the window. The continuity or the I saw no evidence that we were God's favorites. You know, should Psi be seen by some as that. So that was certainly a loss. But again, the gain that I speak about is that I think we can speak well to these things anyway. We have resources within our tradition that will allow us to affirm and to be comfortable in a world in which these phenomena really happen. So that's the good news. I'll return now to the text. Let me add one caveat before beginning, however. I will be arguing in this paper that Mormonism has many resources for affirming Psi, that Joseph Smith seemed to grasp or at least intuit several important truths about the nature of things. Let me be clear, however, that in so doing, I am no way claiming that I believe Mormonism to be the deepest context, and that Joseph Smith is who we should turn to for our science, and isn't it neat that the physicists are now climbing a mountain only to find Joseph staring back at them? That is not what I'm claiming. I'm excited to have found places where I believe we've got wonderful resources for living richly in the new universe I will be outlining. However, I'm not in any way trying to prove Mormonism by this endeavor. Now, I need to be careful here because I very much enjoyed Lynn Bishop's presentation yesterday. So maybe some of you were there. Lynn and I have been reading the same material. I brought some of it here. But we seem to read it from a different angle. Lynn seems to read the scriptures literally. God is light. And he has been, you know, doing wonderful explorations in these things. Isn't it neat that quantum science, the holographic paradigm, and these things sort of affirm what the scriptures say literally? I'm coming from the opposite direction. I'm trying to say, here it is, bubbling up on the fringes. You know, these things that we can pretty much ignore most of the time, but, you know, they're out there. We got to kind of, they're the little niggles, the little black clouds on the horizon. Must that universe be like, and can we speak to it? So rather than this stuff proving Mormonism, I'm just saying, what can Mormonism say and be conversant with and affirm and be adequate to these things? And Tom, if there's time at the end, if you can kind of watch, maybe if I get 2 or 3 minutes to just go over a couple of these books that he and I are both reading, and I read profitably the ones that he counts on as proving it, but yet I wanted to just kind of differentiate a little bit between some of these items. Let me briefly outline the flow of today's presentation. Because some familiarity with terms as well as some limits to a discussion is important, I will begin by presenting the major types of psi that are most of interest to us. Scott's put those up on the overhead. Following that, I'll briefly speak to the marginalization of psi. That is, I will note two features of the dominant modern scientific paradigm that makes the occurrences and powers under this discussion paranormal, yet which I believe Mormonism fundamentally rejects. In the third section, I will introduce what I believe to be one of the most evocative models about the foundational nature of reality on the scene today, the holographic model, best articulated through the work of neurophysiologist Carl Prebram and physicist David Bohm. And then finally, highlighting features of this model, I will then suggest what I see as the resources in Mormon thought for conversing or feeling comfortable with these elements and the new paradigms emerging. Let's begin. In every project that attempts to draw together a large amount of material and distill it into a model that illuminates us at all, it's very important to define terms and place limits. Toward this end, here is a chart I've prepared. As you can look at the chart, there are two major areas. There's receptive psi, which is sometimes referred to as psi gamma, and expressive psi, or psi kappa. Receptive psi is characterized by primarily, ostensibly, paranormal cognition, the ability to receive data in an other than contiguous chain of causal, you know, electrons and photons, et cetera, way. Expressive psi is paranormal action. In receptive side, the major phenomenon is ESP, which includes telepathy or thought or mind reading, which you probably all know what that is, channeling or automatic writing, in which a person is said to produce speech, channeling, or scripts, automatic writing without the control of the conscious self. Clairvoyance or remote viewing, literally the word means clear seeing, and clairaudience is also a thing, clear hearing, in which the agent is said to have the ability to see persons and events that are distant in time or space. And then within that basic classification, you have retrocognition, knowing about the past through some sort of non-contiguous means, premonition, or apparent precognition. I just want to quickly go over that. You put the brackets around apparent is because that is a very tricky one, because to have true precognition, the model that most people say you must assert is that the events have already happened and they're exerting causal influence back. And so many parapsychologists have come up with alternate theories that use many of these other things to sort of explain how the future isn't written and acting back on the past, giving us the information. But, so you can sort of still talk prophecy and all that stuff in a comfortable way. But at least for this, I won't be dealing with that in any kind of detail. But apparent precognition is just an important thing to kind of quickly note. Psychometry or object reading, in which the agent is able to be aware of the character, surroundings, or events connected with an individual by touching or holding an object, such as a watch or a ring, that individual possessed and that was strongly identified with that person. And then crystal gazing, which is crystal ball, seer stones, a scryer with the aid of a crystal or some transparent object able to, through clairvoyant means, to see visions or words in the crystal itself. The other half, expressive psi, exert causal influence on objects distance from ourselves. And this is psychic healing, which I won't go into any detail. Thought transference, the opposite of thought reading. Here I'm putting my thoughts to you. Poltergeist phenomena. It's usually associated with young children, women, and epileptics. It literally means rattling ghost. The word means that. And so it sometimes looks like it's apparitions that you're dealing with and all that, but most parapsychologists have come to understand that it's always centered around a particular person, it seems to be, who has some sort of energy that is able to subconsciously move heavy objects and cause spontaneous bleeding or all sorts of sort of macro, large-scale PK or psychokinesis phenomena. And then the last one, the most difficult one, materialization, dematerialization, which objects seem to literally materialize or dematerialize in empty space. It's the most difficult to believe. There's some psychical researchers that want to make it its own category, psi epsilon, but it's not that difficult. I keep it where it is there. These are the two broader classifications most of interest to my purposes, yet by no means do these exhaust the kinds of phenomena studied under the umbrella of psychical research. The other primary third area of interest, and indeed it was the catalyst to the founding of the earliest parapsychological societies, is the evidence for postmodern survival, which has its own label, Psi Theta. This area's parapsychology deals with possibilities for proving the survival of the spirit beyond physical death. It includes near-death experiences, evidences of otherworldly contact through mediumship phenomena, cases of ostensible spirit possession, and encounters with ghosts or apparitions. The reason it sometimes isn't regarded on an equal footing alongside the other two is that other than the claim that there literally is life after the death, the great majority of the evidences fall under the other two classifications. In addition to the ones mentioned, there are scores of other phenomena that are generally agreed to fit somewhere within the scope of the field, although their exact categorization is sometimes less clear. Many of these center on what have been termed extraordinary functioning or metanormal abilities, some sort of enhancement of visual, auditory, or other senses. Some of these include the phenomenon of Indian running. Has anyone read the Alvin Maker series that Scott Card? He's picked up on that. And the idea that he calls it green song, the ability to be so in tune to be energized possibly by the cosmos. Highly developed somatic regulatory abilities of yogis, mystics, shamans, and other religious adepts. Stigmata, luminous phenomena, levitation, and so forth are also under study. There's the placebo effect. Hypnosis, especially unusual capabilities that are under hypnosis. Animal psi, such as the homing abilities in bird species, and especially psi trailing, in which an animal mysteriously finds its owner, who has moved far away to a place that that animal has never visited. Others have attempted to place the study of extraterrestrial or UFO phenomenon, astrology, or palmistry under the same umbrella, but most parapsychologists do not generally recognize these as falling properly within the field. As many are attuned to the themes within the current discussion of postmodernism know, one of the most subtle and influential of all manipulations of language concerns the definition of the word normal. Declaring who or what is normal is truly one of the ultimate powers. Nowhere in this has this razor been wielded with such far-reaching consequences as it was in the 17th century with the genesis of what has been laid of the modern scientific worldview, which is the dominant paradigm still enthroned today as the way the world works. It is also the set of ideas responsible for marginalizing the psi, in other words, making such phenomenon para-normal. Because it is so dominant and very seldom challenged, parapsychologists and speculative thinkers who tend to take quite seriously the body of evidences for the actual real occurrences of psi phenomenon represent a serious challenge to this worldview and its defenders. Were such phenomena to be admitted as fully natural, parapsychology would be a revolutionary science. It would demand a radical reframing and understanding about the nature of matter, spirit, and human potential. So what are the features of the current scientific model that parapsychology challenges and that I also believe Mormonism rejects? Most historians point to two, both related to the central feature of the new philosophy that emerged in the 17th century, the mechanistic doctrine of nature. Often referred to in its time as the new mechanistic philosophy, this view radically altered the previously accepted, primarily animistic worldview in two major areas. First, the mechanistic worldview eliminated all spontaneity, self-motion, and self-determination from nature. In other words, it enthroned a doctrine of materialistic determinism, the idea that matter is essentially dead, something only to be acted upon by external causes. In a later form, it also declared that the mind and the brain are somehow identical. Second, the mechanistic doctrine entailed, and this point is crucial for marginalizing psi, it enthroned the idea that there could be no action at a distance. In short, the mechanistic philosophy demands that all causal influence occur through direct contact, such as the actions of billiard balls. In its doctrine of perception, then requires sensationalism. All of our experiences, all our information we receive from the external world comes via the senses, arriving in a contiguous chain from the object to the experiencing subject via touch, chemical reactions, photons, etc., that are then transmitted by neurotic firings to the brain. Its further implication is that events and things separated from each other beyond the reach of the senses clearly cannot and do not interact at a distance. Both of these premises seem so reasonable given our everyday experience with the world around us. Yet, as I alluded to above, I believe Mormon metaphysics, like the models being nurtured in today's presentation, explicitly reject both. In a longer version of the paper, I then argue that although the modern worldview seems to match most of our daily experiences, we shouldn't presuppose that it works well for everything except psi. It really doesn't. We therefore need to live more deliberately out of a worldview in which both of these features of the modern worldview are rejected. That is, we must look for models that allow for action at a distance and in which experience and spontaneity are seen as fully natural features of the world, characteristic of nature at every level. As I mentioned above, I believe Latter-day Saint thought already has resources for this worldview. In saying this, I believe I am placing us squarely within a familiar, long-held Mormon claim that ultimately nothing is miraculous in the sense that it is supernatural. We have a history of arguing that were all the features of reality known as they are to God, we would see that these extraordinary events are ultimately natural. But before commenting on these features, I will turn to some of the key elements of the new models I've been speaking. I'll spend the bulk of my time in this section discussing what has been termed the holographic paradigm, best articulated through the work of Carl Prebram and David Bohm. But before I tend to that, I feel I'd at least mention, I had a 6-page mention of these in an earlier draft, but I want to quickly just touch on them. Models or precursors or ideas that have fed into these later models that help us realize the possibility of psi. The first one I wanted to just mention was Kant. Kant certainly wasn't a believer in parapsychology, but yet his big revolution was the idea that we help structure our experience, that we just don't receive the world blank, but through categories of our mind or something, we structure and make experiencing possible. Now, he didn't believe that we could get to this noumenal realm. It was beyond the reach of these categories, but yet the idea that we actively contribute to our experience is a very important thought. A couple hundred years later, Henri Bergson, French philosopher, talked about how he seems that one of the functions of our brain and our nervous system is actually to filter out non-sensory perception. The reason your brains and everything would do that is because sensory perception is most applicable and most important for your survival and for your interactions with the rest of the world. So naturally, because it comes the strongest and it's the most important, your brain is trained to do that. Doesn't mean that that's all that you're experiencing, but certainly it acts that does it. And so, of course, parapsychologists say, well, look at the extraordinary states of meditation or something that people have to be in order to quiet this noise of the sensory data to maybe receive those signals that would be just static, you know, background static otherwise. After Bergson, I wanted to mention that the best systematic treatment or the best systematic philosophy that can handle psych really quite well is the process philosophy, process theology of Alfred North Whitehead, Charles Hartshorne. Now, with regard to parapsychology, David Griffin is doing wonderful work, and I just can't talk too much about that. I had several pages on the work of Rupert Sheldrake, who's a biologist, a contemporary biologist, and his theories about morphic fields. Which is his idea of the way that members of a species sort of communicate with each other across space and time. They share information and behaviors. It has much resonance, and I recommend it highly. I brought a couple of his books. One of the things that it has great potential for explaining is how biology or evolution seems to occur in fits and starts. We don't see the slow, gradual thing. We see a lot, and then all of a sudden we seem to have a pretty major change in a fairly short period of time. And his field of morphic resonance kind of began with that puzzle in biology. A book that might be really interesting to some kind of go into it in an easy way is this new book that came out last year, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. It's great for animal psi, which have lots of references or resonances with human psi. If you want to go a little bit more straight to the science and what he thinks he's doing and the evidences, and he holds contests for people to come up with ways to experiment and to test for these morphic fields, it's very interesting to read The New Science of Life or his other book, The Presence of the Past. So I recommend Sheldrake, but I just don't have time to do much with him today. The holographic paradigm. In my opinion, it's about 2 seconds away from that. Okay, in my opinion, the most impressive of all the new models for the fundamental structures of the universe has been labeled the holographic paradigm, stemming from its depiction of the universe itself as sharing much in common with the principles behind and the actual properties of holograms. As many of you might know, holograms are three-dimensional images that are created by the interference patterns that arise when a laser light is split, and one beam is bounced off the object to be photographed, and the second beam is allowed to combine with the reflected light of the first. The resulting wave interference pattern is then recorded on film. And then the next one, Scott. The image of the film looks nothing like the original object. But when a laser or a bright light is shined through it, the original object appears in eerily convincing three dimensions. Many of you have likely seen holograms, either in person at some of the hands-on science museums, or certainly in Star Wars, as R2-D2 gives you the image of Princess Leia, help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope, that sort of thing. Now, the most outstanding feature of holography, and especially the one most pregnant with ramifications with the study of psi, especially influence at a distance, is that even if the film is cut into pieces, unlike ordinary film in which each piece will only reveal a portion of the object contained on it, each part of the holographic film contains all of the information recorded in the whole. Shine the light on any portion of the film, and the entire object will appear. Now, it certainly appears better at the center than at the end, but you know, shine even like it shows there at the very edge of that, and you'll still get the basic outlines of the entire image. Okay, just turn it off for a minute. Yeah. Carl Pribram is a neurophysiologist at Stanford who found the principles of holography to be a key catalyst for his theories about memory, especially how memories are stored by the brain. Because of earlier research in which areas of the brains of epileptic patients were stimulated and caused near-perfect recall of particular events in that subject's life, a long-held theory in brain science was that every memory was stored in a specific location in our brain cells, in what was labeled engrams. No one quite knew what an engram was, but most scientists were confident that given time they would figure it out. Pribram himself never had any reason to doubt the engram theory until he began working with a scientist, Carl Lashley, who was experimenting with memory and engrams in rats. In his experiments, Lashley would train rats to run through a maze and then would remove portions of their brains, literally aiming to cut out the area of the rat's brains containing the memory that led to these maze-running abilities. To his surprise, he found that no matter what portion of their brains he removed, he could not eradicate their memories. Even with massive portions of their brains removed, their memories remained stubbornly intact. Pribram pondered for a few years over these findings, broadening his study to accounts of human cases in which portions of brains of humans were removed for medical reasons, but in which none of the patients suffered the loss of specific memories. Removals of portion of the brain may cause memory to become generally hazy, but no one reported selective memory loss. After reflecting on these astounding and unexpected findings, Pribram began to theorize that memories were not localized at specific brain sites, but were somehow spread out or distributed throughout the brain as a whole. How excited he was to learn about the principles behind and the phenomena associated with holograms. If it was possible for every portion of a piece of holographic film to contain all the information necessary to create a whole image, then it seemed it might be possible for every part of the brain to contain all of the information necessary to recall a whole memory. The question then became, what wave-like phenomenon might the brain be using to create its internal holograms? The answer he advanced concerns the nature of the electrical communications between the brain's nerve cells, or neurons. It's been widely known for some time that these activities do not occur alone. Neurons possess branches like trees. And when an electrical message reaches the end of one of these branches, it radiates outward as it does a ripple in a pond. Because they're packed so tightly together, these expanding ripples of electricity, a wave-like phenomenon, are constantly crisscrossing each other, pre-gram theorizing, certainly able to produce a holographic sort of memory. Working in the field of quantum physics, David Bohm came to sense the interconnected whole-in-each-part nature of the universe through his work with plasmas. Plasma is a gas that contains a high density of electrons and positive ions. To his amazement, Bohm found that once an electron or ion became part of a plasma, they stopped behaving like individuals and started behaving as if they were part of a large and interconnected whole. Although their individual movements appeared random, vast numbers of electrons produced effects that were surprisingly well organized. To Bohm, it seemed that the electron sea was alive. He continued his works turning into metals. Once again, he discovered that seemingly haphazard movements of individual electrons in metals managed to produce highly organized overall effects. Entire oceans of particles seemed to behave as if each particle knew what untold trillions of others were doing. In this observation, it seemed that every previous idea about subatomic particles was being stood on its ear. Instead of parts organizing into wholes, it seemed the behavior of the individual parts were actually organized by some deeper pattern of wholeness. Bohm began to postulate that wholeness is, in some ways, the more primary reality. This notion led Bohm to think more deeply about the nature of order. From observations, he realized that there were different degrees of order in everything, which in turn implies that perhaps there's no end to the hierarchies of order that exist in the universe. Perhaps the things that we perceive as random or disordered actually aren't disordered at all. Perhaps their order is such of an infinitely high degree they appear to us only as random. As luck, or the great order, would have it, while thinking about this, Bohm saw a device on a BBC television program that helped him develop this idea further. The contraption was a specially designed jar with a large rotating cylinder. The narrow space in the between the cylinder and the jar was filled with glycerin, a thick, clear liquid. And floating motionlessly within the glycerin was a drop of ink. What caught his attention is that when the handle was turned, the drop of ink spread out throughout the glycerin, seeming to disappear. But as soon as the handle was turned in the opposite direction, the faint tracing of ink slowly collapsed upon itself and once again formed a droplet. Then they did it with several droplets. Put one in, stir it up, put another one in, stir it up, put another one in, stir it up, so they're all disappeared. Back it up, back it up, back it up. First one drop, then the other drop, then the third drop would reappear. Bohm writes, "This immediately struck me as very relevant to the question of order. Since the ink drop was spread out, it still had a hidden or non-manifest order that was revealed when it was reconstructed or reconstituted. On the other hand, in our usage, we say that the ink was in a state of disorder when it was diffused throughout the glycerin. This led me to see new notions of order must be involved here." When he discovered the hologram, Bohm found even a better metaphor for understanding order. As the ink drop in its dispersed state, the interference patterns recorded on a piece of holographic film also appear disordered to the naked eye. Both possess orders that are hidden or enfolded in much the same way that the order in the plasma is enfolded in the seemingly random behavior of each of its particles. Perhaps the universe actually employed similar principles. Perhaps it was itself some sort of giant flowing hologram of sorts, which, because of its dynamic nature, Bohm prefers to call a holo movement. In this model, every part is, at a very deep level, connected and fed by this deep structure, what he labels the implicate order. And as such, and of interest to us discussing psi today, every part is capable of providing some knowledge of every other. Bohm was not finished, however. He further theorized that rather than ours being a universe of things or discrete entities, the universe might best be seen as characterized as all things being patterns of energy. Although each pattern might appear to be unique and separate from all others, this stability is more akin to the eddies or whirlpools that form in a flowing river. Just as it is impossible to determine exactly where any whirlpool ends and the river begins, so it is with things in the universe, including us. We and all other entities are deeply interconnected at the most fundamental level. According to Bohm, it's an abstraction to think of ourselves as ultimately separate things. In his language, we are not things, but relatively independent subtotalities. I know that makes you all feel warm and fuzzy. Implications to Mormonism. In my shortened version of this, of the section on marginalization of psi, due to the modern mechanistic worldview, I suggested that what was needed to affirm psi was to much more see some form of spontaneity and self-determination as part and parcel of the very structure of all existence, and that we need a system that was once more considers influence or action at a distance as a fully natural part of the universe. My argument in this section is that Mormonism already contains these resources in its notions of intelligences as the fundamental units of reality, and the light of Christ is an acknowledgement of deep interconnectedness. According to Joseph Smith's revelations and teachings, intelligence is the fundamental stuff of the universe. In one place, we learned it is continuous with matter. In another, that it acts for itself. In another, that the nature of this action is to cleave unto more intelligence. B.H. Roberts talked about intelligence like intuitively, just cleaving to other intelligence. It intuitively wants to grow, to be creative, to engage in relations. He says, as a moth leaps towards the flame at that deep level, and this will help us as we imagine the really small things that don't have a consciousness to sort of intuitively still work this way. We as Latter-day Saints hold further that in our deepest essence, we are intelligences, and that we are now clothed in spiritual and physical bodies, which themselves are also made up of other intelligences. In each of these teachings, Smith elucidates a fundamental pan-experientialism, the idea that all entities have some degree of experience, some level of self-determination. In short, for Mormons, the universe is to some degree alive, with every element playing its small or large role. So deep is this commitment to honoring the self-determining nature of all elements, the accretion account in the Book of Abraham and the Pearl of Great Price speaks of the gods watching to see if the elements would respond to their creative activities. The Mormon commitment seems to be a god or gods who work with intelligent entities, luring each towards greater complexity, greater joy, in each in its own sphere. Intimately tied to the notion of intelligence as the fundamental units of the universe is the Latter-day Saint concept of the light of Christ. It was introduced in the Book of Mormon as simply the light by which you may judge good from evil, roughly equivalent to your conscience. Yet later it was expanded and many new dimensions were added. In section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants, it is described as in all things and the power by which all things were made. In the same section, it is said to be the light that gives us light, that enlightens our eyes, the same light that quickens our understandings. The revelation further declares that it fills the immensity of space. It is the light which giveth life to all things and by which all things are governed. A careful rehearsal of the ideas above yield much of interest of our task of trying to portray a non-sensationist doctrine of perception and the possibilities of influence of action at a distance as fundamental to the Mormon vision. The first thing to note is that whatever intelligences may be, they have the light of Christ internal to them, somehow organizing and governing them. Since only a minuscule number of entities in the universe have sense organs, yet do have the light of Christ as internal constituents capable of communicating with them and luring them towards richer experiences, it is clear that we as Mormons already possess or postulate a universe in which the primary mode of perception is non-sensory. It is the natural mode of perception. Second, through these passages and others, I believe it's a very short step to assert that the notion of the light of Christ names a fundamental Mormon commitment to the radical interconnectedness between all things, and that each intelligence is somehow internally related to every other intelligence. We and all things in our fundamental selves might thereby be seen as patterns of intelligent energy, akin to a geyser of water as it gushes out of a fountain. Although apparently fundamentally discrete, like the geyser, it is constantly being renewed from the water or steam underground. Every entity in the universe is at a deep level, constantly being sustained, taught, renewed by a steady influx from the light of Christ, this deeper order. We, below the level of ordinary consciousness, and less complex entities in their normal non-sensory modes of communication, are naturally both continuous with and sharing information with all other entities in the universe. Just as with the hologram, each part, to some extent, contains the whole. With these resonances, how might we, as Mormons, interpret some of the paranormal phenomenon mentioned earlier? If we recall, receptive psi was characterized by paranormal cognition. Looking at these phenomenologically, we see that the reason each is paranormal, as defined by the modern mechanistic worldview, is because each would involve action at a distance. Either spatial distance, as in telepathy, remote viewing, or psychometry, or temporal distance, as in retro or precognition. Although paranormal in the mechanistic sense, we as Latter-day Saints conceive them as fully natural, at least in the sense that our metaphysical notions don't rule them out. I have asserted that the governing action of the light of Christ obviously implies that non-sensory perception is the fundamental mode of communication in the universe, and add to this the way our lives as energies, intelligences that are enfolded within and nurtured by this deep ordering principle, we can easily understand the possibility of all ESPs, all extrasensory perceptions, especially telepathy, remote viewing, and crystal gazing. Remembering and extending the light of Christ that teaches us all things, the light which quickens our understanding, Pre-Brehm's holographic model for how memory works, stored in vibrational or wave interference patterns that are then recollected, recollected, or remembered, pulled together again, we can easily understand retrocognition and apparent precognition. As I mentioned, true precognition would involve a bigger side trip, but I think we could play it out satisfactorily, at least to most of us. If we add more explicitly our understanding of all things possessing intelligence, then psychometry can also be affirmed. It would be extrasensory access to the internal experiences of the intelligence that make up the object itself. Whereas remote viewing, you're looking at the external. With psychometry, you're sort of getting inside the experience of the objects themselves. For instance, objects could incorporate memories of sorts about events that occurred in their proximity, or have a deep felt affiliation, or you know, feelings for, you know, if it's the ring that I wore my whole life, the intelligence within that could have some sort of this that would then trigger, even if it's very vague, some sort of a way for the psychometrist to access information about events that happened in that in the vicinity of that object or something. Very interesting possible parallels for why certain places seem to possess their own power. Maybe the Sacred Grove contains memories of that within there. So people go and experience that, and maybe you're possibly fed by that, not just the Holy Ghost descending upon them, but maybe right there that has it. There's interesting cases, if you wanted to read it a little bit the other direction, that we can create energy of such. And so many people going and feeding the psychic space with their positive affirmations could, again, also do that. There's really some fun stuff about apparitions, Marian visions, and various things throughout the literature that show that when people are interested, they appear regularly. After 3 years of Mary showing up every night at this place, people lose interest, and slowly she begins to fade, and slowly and disappear eventually. So anyway, I took longer because I talked more than I thought. I'm going to skip expressive side, but we certainly are able to do it if we say that to exist is to not only be fed, but to be influential throughout the universe. It's a few short steps to do that. Maybe we'll do it in question and answer. And before turning the time over to Randy, let me, however, suggest a possible Latter-day Saint framework for the question, what do we make of psi? What do we make of extraordinary abilities? My suggestion is that although remarkable and unusual, however not paranormal, now that they're seen as part of a natural deep order, these abilities might be read to us as part and parcel of the sort of powers that can and will be acquired by anyone as she or he progresses on the God path. However, like siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I-S, in Hindu thought, which is their term for the amazing abilities of certain yogis, they are not to be sought for, per se, although they will very likely arise as the disciple progresses in his or her attempts to more closely unite their conscious with their subconscious selves, which, if we think about it, is a key element in almost all meditative, prayerful, spiritual disciplines. Just as with the warning, beware of siddhis in the East, we as Latter-day Saints should not look to evidence of such abilities as necessarily indicating great spiritual advancement. They could mean just that. It's not enough to simply say they do mean that. For whatever reason, some people seem to naturally be more talented at developing certain states of mind than others. It does not follow, however, that they are always equally talented in the understanding wisdom aspects of the training. To some is given one gift, and to some is another. One final thought. It is said that God is aware of every lily and the fall of every sparrow. I believe that through these modes and their applications to psi, and in dialogue with the resources of our own tradition, we can assert with some feeling that we too already have the same awareness. The challenge, and I think it's a big one, it'd be easy to say, oh, I want to know where that sparrow is or that lily is. The challenge is to be willing to be open, to really feel both the external and the internal experiences of everything. That's God. openness, largeness, the ability, the power to be influenced and to be allow yourself to be influenced and to fall into pain and deep torture. That's Godhood. So we possess these things. The trick would be to bring them to our consciousness, to welcome them into our sphere of our embrace. And I thank you for listening today.
I had called my response, "No man hath seen pure space." Who knows where that quote's from?
If I could hide.
Yes, that's right. That's an LDS hymn. There seems to be something about scientists and philosophers and theologians that, as my kids would say, freaks out at the notion of vacuum, of pure space. And I will leave that as a backdrop for what Dan's theory of everything desires to, in some sense, explain. I think what I'd like to do is focus on a couple of quick items. Dan said he wasn't an experiential psi person. I would argue that he is, as well as we all are, if we broaden the concept of psi to what we call human imagination and the very old philosophic problem of where does the new come from? And the whole idea of a psychic experience being paranormal as that which is unmeasurable, unscientifically replicable, and is can be easily applied to human feelings that are notoriously unmeasurable, to human imagination, to a lot of the things that we take for granted as current psychology is attempting to get into the black box and merely hit this node of the brain here and we'll figure it all out. I think we'll find that ultimately, that my view is, and anyhow, that the irreducible nature of what we call the person's imaginative self or